Group meeting, Sunday, 10th January, 1988. This man, Jesus, was man, and the last word man is printed in capitals, because I used capitals when I meant a person who had really come to the culminating point of human development as such, which of course means that he had realized holistic consciousness. His real name in Hebrew was Yahshua. Jesus and Judah are two different forms of the same name, Yahshua. Yod, He, Shein, Vav, He. Now you'll notice that the Shein, our English S, comes in between Y, H, and W, H. What does this Shein do? And in connection with that, we considered for a few moments the Hebrew system of gematria, where every letter of the alphabet stands not merely as an alphabetical letter linguistically, philologically, but it stands for some profound metaphysical concept. It also stands for a mystical reality. And both of these, the metaphysical concept brings in the philosophy which is associated with the Kabbalah and so forth, and the mystical aspect brings in these changes which take place in the consciousness of the individual who is growing spiritually till he reaches his fulfillment as the full-fledged true human. So now, what does the Shein do? Consider the two end, the two halves, Yod He and Vav He. Yod He and Vav He are Yahweh, Jehovah, God Himself, translated in the Bible always as the Lord. Elohim is the term which is always translated as God. Then, of course, there are other terms like Adonai, El Shaddai, and so forth. You see? But Yahweh by itself is only a timeless potentiality. It is not enfleshed. It is bloodless. When Yahweh, the divine immanence in each and every one of us, comes to fulfillment, Yahweh comes into action. So the Shein stands for that kind of relationship. So Yahshua really means Yahweh in action, in manifestation. Now, you know how Jesus asked his disciples, What do men say I am? And they told him that they say you are Jeremiah or one of the old prophets, come back again. And Simon Peter says, in a flash of divine inspiration, he says, you are the living Christ, the Son of God. But it was only a flash, in Simon Peter, and he disappeared after he had said those words. Because when Jesus went on to predict what would be happening to him and how there would come the crucifixion and so forth, it was Simon Peter who turned around and said, it should not be like that for you. Peter was for establishment, on the grand scale and so forth. So Jesus turns round upon him and says, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savourest not the things of God, but the things of man." They are fateful words, and they are extraordinary words altogether, for the simple reason that Jesus knew what happened when truth was organized, that is to say, the truth about the spiritual culmination of man's development. When they are organized by followers who get into the habit of repeating the words, manufacturing rituals and so on, the living truth becomes ultimately just dormant. So that's why he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Now, the word Satan, according to the Hebrew nomenclature, Shein, Tau, Nun, you see, represents continuity in manifestation, constantly obstructing its own self-destruction. Now, you know how all the world seeks continuity. Something's good, right, let's have it forever and ever. Now, that is a profound error altogether. I'll explain that a little bit later. And Satan stands for that. He also stands for the accuser. He also stands for the ordinary English meaning of the devil, you see. It's the devil who prevents further creative growth by insisting upon continuity, fixation, establishment, you see. Death plays a very important part in our growth, one of the most important parts. I'll deal with that in a moment. You see, the three things, death, love, and creation, go together. What is love in the transcendent sense? We human beings who are still at a subhuman stage, not human in the sense of the full-fledged human, the blissful creator stage, you see. We who are in the subhuman stage experience love as attraction, as possession, and it's a romantic thing. It's a thing of the feelings only, as such. But love in its transcendent reality is identical with the creative power of the primordial creative energy, which is self-replenishing, everlasting, and it never stops creating. This is a very important point which, as far as I'm aware, none of the theologies has expounded clearly. It's only in the Zarathustrian scriptures that you find a statement which bears that out. It says that God pronounced the creative word. Now, obviously, God doesn't speak any language at all that we speak, and he never chatters like we do. God only creates. It is a creative energy which is ceaselessly creative. This is the important point. And in that scripture it is said that the creative word has to be constantly repeated. When there was a pause in the repetition, evil crept in. Now think of it. If we are not in the state of consciousness, and in our thought and feeling, our word and our deed, constantly doing the right thing, the good thing, evil can creep in when we are slack. That is why in Buddhist teaching, for instance, samasati, perfect mindfulness, is emphasized so very strongly. And Jesus said, watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. The Son of Man really means the Son of Mind, because mind is that archetypal form of the primordial creative energy which exercises a formative influence. Formative in the sense of a truly creative influence. It brings in what is new, and the new is always ahead of that which went before. You see? It is not new in our ordinary sense of the word, like chucking the old furniture out of the room and filling it with new furniture. Not new in that sense. So now, love is creative energy, and this creative energy manifests practically in terms of the manifested universe. The whole of the cosmos is the manifestation of this creative energy, and it is perpetually changing because the creative energy never stops creating. It creates anew all the time. I say all the time, but actually I should say through all eternity. Because time is a limiting factor. Eternity isn't. That is the normal context of the divine consciousness, which is the holistic consciousness as such. So now, where manifestation is concerned, we have birth and death, beginning and ending. But where the creative activity of the transcendent in eternity is concerned, there is no beginning and ending. There is no birth and death. There is constant creative activity which transcends our experience of this activity. We experience it as beginning, ending, birth, death, and so on. And we experience, therefore, continuity, which is the link between birth and death, and so forth. And newness in our sense of the word newness. But death is essential for the new to come into being. If one tries to think in analogical terms, if there is a house which is very old and it is crumbling, well, what do? You break it down and build a new on it, on that ground, don't you? It's like that. Death is essential, therefore. It is not death which is destruction or annihilation. It is death which is an essential aspect of new creation. If we understand death that way, we would not only lose the fear of death and many other unhappy things we would lose, but also we would be ready to welcome death as and when it comes. Now, in this connection, the Buddha gave a very interesting teaching. He taught, do not cling to life. How do we cling to life? As the perpetuation of that which actually is. That's how we cling to life. Continuity. And he also taught, do nothing to precipitate death. Now, who has common sense? A Buddha or human beings who exist on the globe? It's the most sensible thing. Do not cling to life. Do nothing to precipitate death. To put it in a good old English slang, don't be a damn fool. Be wise. Understand life and the real meaning and process of life. If one can really become conscious of this, one begins to see the meaning of eternal life. Eternal life is not continuous life. It is the life-death pulse, and life-death are simultaneous. In eternity, past, present, future are together in immediacy, the immediate here now. And that is the meaning of the context of eternity and infinity. Now, Jesus' life had to work up to the crucifixion. It fell to the lot of Judas to be the means of the right consummation. Now remember that we say Judas, but the name Judas in Hebrew is Yehuda. 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 The meaning of that name is a Jew. Yeah, a Yehuda. In India, in South India, for instance, where there are plenty of Jews, and also in the big cities of India, they are called Yahudis. That means Jews, you see. Now, the name Yehuda has its own specific meaning, and especially its significance in terms of the letter, number, significance of the Hebrew language. And Yehuda and Yahshua have the same letters in the Hebrew and the same numbers, with the exception of Yahshua, which has the Shin, whereas Yehuda has Dalet, the D, you see, in between these. Now the D stands for getting rid of the old. Manifestation is made unmanifest because of the Dalet. I know this is all rather difficult Kabbalistic stuff, but it is well worth considering. So, Judas was the one who had to be the instrument for bringing about the true fulfillment of Yahshua. Because by the death of Yahshua, the Shein disappears and only Yahweh, God Himself, the Lord Himself, is left. You see? Out goes the manifestation. The manifestation had to do its job, and it did its job extremely well. And when the time came, Jesus dipped the bread in the sop and gave it to Judas and said, what thou doest, do it quickly. You remember how the story goes in the Bible? And Judas brought the forces of destruction near Jesus that fateful night, and the rest of the drama took place. Now Jesus gave only one commandment. Love ye one another as I have loved you, was the one commandment of Jesus, his very own. Commune with those words, as I have loved you. How does transcendence love? How does the embodied transcendence love? It can only love creatively, which includes in perfection all the most developed forms of love that we humans who are still at a subhuman stage know of and can exercise, which includes, of course, death, creation and death. So love, death and creation, all three, they go together as such. Judas has been called the betrayer. But was he the betrayer or was he the deliverer? Because by his action, Jesus was delivered from bondage to manifestation. You see, there's a French theologian, Dr. Segan, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name, who in the French translation of St. John's Gospel, says not betray, but livrera, delivered Jesus. Whosoever receives Judas and his work, receives Jesus, therefore, actually. And in receiving Jesus, one receives Yahweh. These are difficult things to understand and grasp. But slowly, slowly, one's eyes open. Now, I've put in a few lines here like this. Yehuda returns and stands at the door of the unseen light. We await the moment, this moment of love. Receive thou me, is the message of the silence. The door is the darkness before which hides the silence. On the instant, Yehuda is within, and the darkness is at one with the light. This is the ever-recurring miracle. We don't see things that way. But I think that is true. That's how it happens. Now let us go back where we left off with the Upanishadic teachings. We all use the word person. It's a very common word, and personality is a very common word in the English language. Oh, he is a great personality and so forth. What do we mean by he's a great personality? He's a big bug, a big man, big in the worldly sense of the term. But see how the Upanishads regarded the word person. The Sanskrit word is Purusha. Purusha. And in the greatest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you have the first chapter, fourth section, first verse, going like this. In the beginning, there was only the Atma. And how is the Atma understood by the Upanishadic teachers? The Atma is the unborn, the ageless, the decayless, the deathless, the stainless, the sorrowless. Now note those words very carefully, because those of you who are deeply conversant with Buddhism will remember that in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, which is an autobiographical sutta by the Buddha himself says, seeking the unborn, he sought the unborn and found the unborn, realized it. Seeking the ageless, the decayless, the deathless, I found, realized the decayless, the ageless, the deathless, the sorrowless, the stainless. Now, they are identical words which you find in the Upanishads. You will find them through and through the so-called minor Upanishads particularly, and amongst the greater Upanishads in the Maitri Upanishad. And I think there's another one too, but I've forgotten at the moment. Where the Atma is presented as the unborn, ageless, decayless, deathless, stainless, sorrowless. Now, this particular verse in the Upanishad goes like this. In the beginning there was only the Atman. Looking around and seeing nothing but himself, he said, I am. Now look, it's mainly European scholars who introduce the word he. It's absurd to speak in terms of he because you think of human beings and you think of the masculine aspect of things only. Atman should really be spoken of as it, just as Brahman should also be spoken of as it. It looked round and seeing nothing but itself. Now you can feel the context of eternity and infinity expressed there. Nothing but itself. It said, I am. Aham. I am. You see? In Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, when Moses asks, you know, it's a burning bush event. Moses asks, the voice of the Lord God comes out of the bush, and he asks, what shall I say to the Israelites when they ask me, who hath sent you? And the voice says, Ehye Asher Ehye. Now here the first Ehye, I believe, I may be wrong, but this is my understanding of it. The first Ehye stands for I am, Moses himself. I am Asher, that Ehye I am, that transcendent I am. I am that transcendent I am. You see, Moses was a prophet. He was the founder of Judaism as such. And therefore, he must have realized full-fledged humanity and had realized holistic consciousness, which of course means the experiencing of the Unio Mystica, as we put it in Christian mysticism. I am that I am. So now, the Upanishad goes on to explain Purusha. It says that this is represented as the Purusha Veda, which means in man form, in the form of a man. Because, you know, the tendency of everything, all that is living and manifested, is to think of the transcendent in its own terms. You know that lovely poem of Rupert Brooke called Heaven. It deals with fish. I'll show it to you afterwards, if you like. It's a marvelous poem. And the fish think of the supreme fish as a wonderful big fish, and so forth, you see. everything is very, very fishy in that poem. How on earth Rupert Brooke had the insight, I don't know, but that was real genius, to put it that way. So, human beings tend to present the transcendent in man form. After all, if you look at all the descriptions, the God descriptions of God, which have been given throughout the scriptures, what are those descriptions? They are potty little descriptions. They are just man apotheosized. All what little virtues we subhumans have are apotheosized, raised to the nth degree, and we say God is that. But God is also what we don't like. You look at Isaiah chapter 45 verse 7. See what he says. He acknowledges that he is also the creator of evil and darkness and so forth. And similarly, in the Gita, Sri Krishna openly says, I am the gambling of the cheat and the splendor of splendid things am I. I am death and also the origin of all things. I am being and non-being. So you see, our common garden conceptions of transcendence are really very, very childish and inadequate and misleading conceptions. By having these conceptions about such and such virtues are superior to this, that and the other, we think in terms of comparison and competition and so forth. I am greater than this fellow. That fellow is greater than me. He is lesser, and this fellow is lesser than I am, and so forth. Which is completely absurd. Or one may say, I am equal to everybody, or everybody is equal to me. Which is again utterly nonsensical. Because every single manifestation in the universe is unique. Even the atoms have different atomic weights of any one chemical element, simply because there are a few more electrons or neutrons, as the case may be, in this, not electrons, but neutrons in this particular element as compared with another. Now, of its own sort. So, to say that I am the equal of anybody or anybody is equal to me is also a foolish statement altogether. It introduces absence of perfect relationship with anything and everything. When all that conceit is out, then one can be in right relationship with anybody and everybody. So now, because before, and the Sanskrit for before is purva, all this, that is manifestation he's talking of, he burned up. The word for the root of the verb for burn is ush. Purva and ush, all evils, therefore he is a person. Now, if you and I burn up all evils, then we are persons. Pur from purva and ush for burn. Purusha. Get it? Now, this is a wonderful teaching. I'm surprised that so many brilliant scholars, both in the West and the East, have not spotted the extraordinary significance of just this statement. And I know certain great American scholars have poo-pooed what is said in the Upanishads, saying it's philologically wrong. Dr. So-and-so's philology is different from Upanishadic realization of transcendence. Atman is devoid of all evils. They manifest only in all this, the existential world as experienced and cognized by us in our impure state by our tainted discriminative consciousness. All evils, sarvam papmana, are all evil states of mind. Out of the heart comes evil. Isn't that somewhere in the Bible? Yes. Evil mentation is the evidence of the sick heart and the diseased mind. He burned up all evils. Burning is effected by tapas, pure attentiveness. Now the literal meaning of tapas, one literal meaning, is warmth. And in Griffith's translations of the Rig Veda, they are very good translations, I like them very much. Still, in the creation hymn, he translates the word tapas as warmth, heat. No. Tapas, and we have in our modern Indian languages, tapas, meaning to watch, to examine. Isn't that so, Kishore? Tapas is to examine. Tapasin is he who examines. So, through tapas, pure attentiveness, which by its intensity generates that psychical heat, Agni, which burns up all evil-mindedness in the earth child. You know that Brahman, the absolute all, the ultimate reality of Hindu writings and teachings and Upanishadic writings too, is described in three words: Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat, Chit, Ananda. Now the middle word, Chit, is usually translated as mind or thought. It has nothing to do with thought. It has to do with that aspect of consciousness which is complete attentiveness. Complete attentiveness means omniscience. That's what it means. That's the middle word. That's the middle word to describe the ultimate reality, the ultimate truth. Sat Chit Ananda, pure attentiveness. And I mentioned this particularly for this reason. Practically the whole of the religious discipline of the religia can be summed up like this. Be conscious of everything that comes to you. Reject nothing, good, bad or indifferent. Reject nothing whatsoever. Be conscious of it as it comes to you or emerges out of you, memory, etc. You see? Without any reaction for or against whatever it may be. If one becomes capable of that kind of attentiveness, one is like God. We say God created the universe. Does he throw anything out of the universe? He doesn't. For one thing, he can't. The cosmos is the total cosmos. There is no dustbin in the cosmos available for the rejects from by God. And there are no rejects. Everything is included. What we call evil is especially our psychical reaction. It's something we don't like or something which hurts us or which causes trouble and illness, disease, pain, sorrow to our environment. That is evil, you see. After all, that is proper conception of evil. But nothing must be thrown out. Simply because if you can pay complete full attention to what you call evil, then there is a form of acceptance which is not the opposite of rejection. It is a form of acceptance which enables a transcendent understanding and love to flow out of you towards that which is evil, which is hurtful, which is painful, which is sorrowful. You see? This is the point. This is how one begins to understand what transcendent love means. I know from experience in my youth how the young adolescent says, "My darling, I'll love you forever and ever unto all eternity." One talks nonsense. But of course, that nonsense is appropriate for that age. It is natural. It is there. It is the beginning. We tend to begin with folly, hoping or trying to culminate with wisdom. Now, he who has burned up all evil-mindedness is now the pure one. In this state, the Holy One, knowing that that Holy One is realized on earth through him himself, is named Purusha. Through the perfected Holy One, that Holy One, transcendence itself, realizes its own transcendence in human form. Its own perfection in human form. You see, we think of everything as a kind of a progression, like going up a tall ladder. It's nothing of the sort. It's everything here now. Transcendence manifests its full transcendence in the perfect flower, the perfect blade of grass, the perfect tree, the perfect mosquito, Anopheles if you like, because it does its duty, it does its business very, very thoroughly. You read Sherrington's Man on His Nature. In the last chapter is an extraordinary description of how that blighted mosquito works in order to propagate its own species and to kill the man. You see? It's absolutely fantastic. But this is all the work of transcendence. And it is transcendence's perfection alone which is the perfection we can ever hope to mirror. So, when the human being has become the perfected Holy One, it is transcendence which realizes its own transcendence as perfect human holiness through that person. If we can really grasp this, even intellectually grasp it, without reaching the culminating point of being fully conscious of it, even if we can intellectually grasp it, out will go all self-conceit. In my young days, I was a frightfully conceited person. I know all about it. Took me about, 70 years practically, and out has gone conceit. What I call I am in actuality just no thing, nothing. And when a person is reduced to his nothingness, he is thereby reduced, he is exalted, in fact, to his fullness. Because he is in that state where his particular uniqueness and his duty to mankind, to the world in which he lives, can get fulfilled properly. This is very important. Humility as a virtue, people try to cultivate. But these are mistakes. Don't try to cultivate virtue. Try to cultivate what is good. I'll tell you why. What is my conception of the good? What is my conception of humility or love or wisdom or beauty or anything? It's the conception of a subhuman who has not yet realized in full what the full-fledged human is, the blissful creator. You see? Therefore, there is no room for self-conceit, no room whatever. But it takes a long time to see that. We must have conceit, because otherwise, in our young days, otherwise we wouldn't have the drive to do what we should be doing in our life. Become a lawyer or a doctor or a prime minister, yes minister, and so forth, you see. But whilst we start by saying, oh, I am going to be the top pugilist of the world or the top snooker player or some such thing, instead of saying that, you start like that, you get the drive towards it, then as you progress towards it, drop the egoism. And then there is purity. Then naturally there is humility. Of the right sort. Not a false modesty. One can wear modesty as a cloak. Oh, I see. I think we must stop there now. It's all right. Let it be. Let it be. Thank you all.
Thank you.